Hello and welcome, dear listeners to Across the Aisle, your space for audio reflection on theatre, culture and the arts in Australia. I am Philip Teal and it's great to have you with us for our usual activity of experiencing and thoughtfully debriefing life as an audience member. As usual, we will discuss two productions this episode, gossip about other things at intermission, and offer some recommendations incoming soon. This month, we take in Sydney Theatre Company's production of The Visitors, staged at the brand new Geelong Performing Arts Centre. We also return to 45 Downstairs for the swan song of Little Ones Theatre, Lesbian Vampires of Sodom. It has been such a rich pleasure to witness these performances, and I can't wait to get into our discussion today. But first, some sad news. This will be the last episode of Across the Aisle for the foreseeable future. We're keen to see where art and the internet go next. But for now, it's all a bit too much with algorithms fighting against making further connections to the people who want to commune with us. We'll say some more in intermission and reflect on what it has meant for us to present and produce 64 award-winning episodes of this podcast, and why, for now, we're hanging up the headphones. But first, let me bring in my confidant and muse, Carla Donnelly. How are you, my dear?
Oh, I am wonderful. Enjoying summer, enjoying Capricorn season, feeling very relaxed. How are you?
Really well. I'm actually just back from Tasmania. I went down to Hobart to revisit Mona and enjoy the sights. So very refreshed, school holiday vibes.
Great. Love to hear about it, maybe in intermission a little bit.
Yeah. Okay, let's dive in to the 64th and final episode. I love the 8x8 numerology of it all. Perfect.
Oh.
Yes. Let's head to Geelong.
Fate, isn't it fate?
The Visitors. It is to do with infinity, completion. Love it.
Eight is fate. Yeah. Okay, so The Visitors. Here is the blurb. On a sweltering day in January 1788, seven clan leaders gather on a sandstone escarpment overlooking the harbour. The attendees, six of them elders and one new initiate, catch up, laugh together, share a meal, and compare notes. But beyond the friendly banter, protocols, and hospitality, a momentous decision is waiting to be made. A mysterious fleet of giant Na'vi is amassing in the harbour, and as they creep closer, these seven representatives must choose unanimously whether to send these strangers on their way or welcome them. So this play is written by Jane Harrison, and it was devised about 10 years ago, and it had its sort of first run at Sydney Festival in 2020, but this is back when Wesley Enoch was the artistic director of Sydney Festival. And this version, this, you know, revamped version is actually directed also by Wesley Enoch. There is so much to talk about here. I think one of the key things for me was when thinking about finishing the podcast for many months is that once I sort of saw this show and, you know, the spiritual wrapping up as well as our spiritual brothers, Little Ones Theatre, I thought, okay, this is actually, I think, the best play I've ever seen, like hands down. And I thought, what a great way to end everything, because it's almost like my searching, the thing that I've been looking for that I didn't know that I needed has happened. And it's hopefully this is just the beginning of the kinds of truth telling and Australian, quote unquote, Australian stories that we're going to now start seeing. There's seven performers on stage, which sounds like a lot, but the way that it's directed and the dialogue is so concise that everybody has a moment to shine, and it all really coheres so well together. So there's Albert, who's representing the South Shore. There's Gordon, who's of Sydney Cove. There's Joseph of the Headlands, Lawrence of Botany Bay, Wallace of the River, Jackie of Manly Cove's North Shore, and Gary of the Northern Parramatta River. The set is all, you know, sandstone, sandy outcrop, very evocative of Sydney and where I grew up. I actually was born not very far away from this place. And I think the thing that really is the starting point here is that the play really drives home that when these elders gather together to talk about their strategy of whether they're going to welcome and what are their ethics and moral responsibilities towards these visitors and what is their cultural responsibilities towards these quote-unquote visitors, the real shoe drop bomb moment of this discussion is that there is no expectation that they will stay, right?
Yeah.
Because why would people want to stay somewhere that is not their country? So just the very fact of that thought that I had never thought before in my life is schism opening, life-changing.
Mm.
And then the play continues to have almost like, it's very funny, like it's very heady, incredible truth-telling material, but it's also, you know, it's very funny. It's mob getting together, having a laugh, having a joke, you know, sharing some food, having important cultural decisions, discussions. It's also very human. It's all, you know, it's at times like a council meeting, you know. There's every kind of archetype in this council. There's the pro, there's the against, there's people that are kind of on the fence. There are people who are just like, will align themselves with whoever has just spoken. And then there's the newbie who's, you know, been sent in as representation, has no idea and is being, you know, all the others are trying to sway them to their arguments. So in terms of like playwright structure, storytelling, it's incredible, but also the message, the time, the place is exactly where we needed to hear it. Like it was written 10 years ago and it's such a, I don't want to say it's bizarre, like it is such a mitzvah, it's such a magical lining up of things that this play was in its first major run at the Sydney Theatre Company, you know, during the referendum and finished on the day of the referendum, you know, and they had to shut down all of their social media comments about the play because there was all these racists about the referendum popping off in the social media posts. So it's just such a confluence of so many things burbling to a head. And then when I think about theatre and I think about the power of theatre and the stories that we tell each other for education, for enlightenment, for political uprising, this is really that everything that I've ever wanted. And when we think about storytelling and we think about the history of so-called Australia, this is where I want it to begin and this is where I hope that it begins. So I'll throw over to you in a sec, Phil, because that's just really a lot of story sort of setting. But when we think about the play itself, there's just so much humanity here. And so really the discussion surrounds, you know, do we go against our cultural protocols, which is our cultural protocols is to welcome everyone who comes to our country and, you know, have this ceremony? Or do we, because of based on previous experience, go against everything that we know and reject these people, push them away, be aggressive? And so the argument goes back and forth there. And the thing that really struck me the most, especially with Delara Williams' character, and Delara Williams herself was, you know, like quite heavily pregnant in the play, which just sort of added this really beautiful community matriarchal gravitas to it, is that She's like, well, these people have come so far. They're really ill prepared for this country. They're really ill prepared for, you know, maybe they're hungry, maybe they're starving. How can we, in our ethical and moral turpitude, turn them away? These are the kinds of accommodations and thinking towards Indigenous people that have never happened. So if we think, if we see this as a beginning of, you know, Australia's history, we already see this incredible juxtaposition, warring of ideas and understandings of country in the world. Okay, that's about as much as I can info dump, Phil.
Yeah, no, we're so on the same wavelength on this one. A real sort of masterpiece of democratic, conversational, conflict but peace-oriented talk theatre. And like, in addition to everything you've said, I'll just say that the language itself, mostly in English, but also with Darug and Darawal language, clearly offering a global audience the experience of being at the point of arrival from the perspective of those who are and have always been already here. The play opens with this not idealized but quite idyllic soundscape and landscape. We really get a sense that things are peaceful here. They might include a rowdy council meeting. There might be a degree to which the local clans have some conflict with each other, but there are ways of living that have survived for forever. And the dramatic irony of who these arrivals are, known to the audience, is so heavy and so suspenseful, and just adds that level of dread, which does start to creep in as the decision about whether to welcome these people incrementally gets closer. But the way that the language has been, let's say, translated into English, as you say, sometimes quite funny. I mean, phrases like, it was incumbent on me as chair. Or, for fuck's sake, you know, to quote Elaine Crombie's character, you think that's a lovely way of thinking back into pre-contact, pre-invasion language use, and to really just humanize and familiarize in this amazingly generous way what it might have been like to be listening in to those discussions. Even some, you know, cliches in English were comically backwards translated. So, curiosity killed the echidna, or a midden wasn't made in a day. Just kept reminding us of that sort of slight absurdity of these characters presenting the play in English, right? Which added this additional layer of darkness and irony. But these superstar performers, I mean, we really had the A-list of First Nations performers in Australia, all gathered, all at Geelong. I mean, it was lovely for you and me as well to have our first experience at the Geelong Performing Arts Centre with this show. And I think the theatre, by the way, as a sidebar, is a really successful space of bringing the stage quite close to the audience in a lounge-like sort of mode. Mm-hmm. They haven't made the mistake of the Melbourne Theatre Company building of just having a vast Viking Hall style environment. There's a real sense of connection and a glow from the stage that is received by the audience. But these performers were at their limit. They were leaving everything on the floor. Like, some of them were losing their voices. There was that heartfelt speech about Palestine after the show by Elaine Crombie. Like, there was just a lot of authentic political material being offered by all of the creators of this show. So it was quite an amazing single act to sit down for. But to come back to your opening statement about this being a truly great play, I think just when it comes to the script, this unrushed, storytelling-based opportunity for different voices to speak towards and around each other, persuasion that is successful, values that are timeless but ultimately can also clash with each other. Added to all of that stuff about the suspense of what we know about these arriving vessels, It made this a truly impactful and memorable play.
Mm.
Thank you, Sydney Theatre Company.
Yeah, there were so many moments that I just wanted to scream, no!
Right, don't do it. Yes, exactly. Classic, almost, and almost pantomime level, you know, don't say yes.
Yeah, and then also then you being brought back by, you know, Delara Williams and Lainey with, well, you know, to not welcome them would be a wound essentially to our cultural heritage and our culture, our day-to-day way of being. You know, like these people have proven not to be trusted.
Indeed.
You know, through violent and strange encounters, you know, over time in many generations, because people had been coming to the shores for many, many, many generations. And yeah, just as I said before, just why they would never have had an expectation that they were going to stay. So how that might have changed the discussion. It might have changed the tenor of how these interactions began. And yeah, you were right, like a very tight 1 hour, just over an hour, incredibly economical and languid storytelling. And again, time and place moment as well with Elaine's Palestine speech. I mean, this play was what, like early November. So it was a few weeks into the conflict and not many people were very much talking about it. And Elaine and the cast came out and did a statement about Palestine and gave us resources in order to be able to be educated and be active about it. But just very clearly saying, like, we know colonization when we see it.
Yeah.
And we are using our platform and our voice to highlight that. And it was absolutely chilling.
Well, and this is the same theatre company that then screwed up in Sydney when they succumbed to their sponsors and lambasted actors for stage during the protest during the curtain call.
Mm.
You know, like this, it was fascinating timing-wise because this First Nations production in Geelong was being far more virulent in their activism, but sort of flying under the radar because it wasn't literally in Sydney.
I think so, because and tragically, and it was talked about by Elaine at the end, is that, you know, this run ended on the day of the referendum. And so obviously the referendum did not go well. And they've had a few weeks in between, you know, that wrapping up and taking it on the road. And I think they would have said something anyway about Palestine. But, you know, the fact that they've been out there doing this play and then the referendum turned out how it did and then Palestine was starting out, they were just like, this is, you know, I'm never going to be quiet about this.
Yeah.
I just want to wrap things up and I'll hear your opinion on this. Like, for me, when I think about my stories by minorities, and it's a huge thing that I get really angry about, because most often the stuff that gets commissioned and produced is educational. Like, this is my life. This is how things affect me. And I always get really angry because it's like, well, when are we going to actually start having these stories, these self-actualized stories, these stories that people can, minorities and marginalized people can, you know, imagine themselves into, like white cis men have, you know, I use that Mark Rothko play all the time. It's like, when are we going to have a play about a fucking, you know, a Louise Bourgeois or something like that? How far away are we from that? And this play felt like something very different. Like, I mean, educational, of course, because it just brought so many new concepts to the table, but it actually felt like such a radical deconstruction of the way that we can potentially envisage stories by Indigenous people in this country.
Yeah, 100%. And the solution to all of our questioning and curiosity has to just be to listen, and maybe to listen like the characters on the stage, modelled for us in a mode of engaged, values-based, patient, democratic attention giving, and for these theatre companies to be hosting environments like this and durational performance experiences like this gives me a sense of hope.
One more thing. Okay. Sorry, I did say there was only one more thing. But the final thing that I really took away from this is the most dangerous thing you can do as a person is maintain your dignity and self-worth in the face of the heteropatriarchal capitalist machine, colonist machine. And it was just so abundantly clear why trans people are so dangerous, why queer people are so dangerous, why anti-Zionist people are so dangerous. Our values and our morals and our cultural heritage is all we have to hold on to that makes us human, and to compromise that, no matter what comes after it, which is the horrible attempted genocide of Indigenous people, is, you know, preferable to actually handing that over in the first place.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely incredible.
Thank you. And I'll see you back there in Geelong soon.
All right. I think we need a big drink after that. Yeah.
Okay. It is intermission. Time for one last beverage and check-in.
Yeah.
Carla, how are you? What's going on? Why is this ending?
Oh,
I'm so mad.
I know. It's just, I mean, it's a long... The abbreviated version is I think like the transition between Internet 2.0 to Internet 3.0 is, you know, happening. And because of that, a lot of things
it's the Google Reader killing the blogs
all
over again.
A lot of that is just condensing into Spotify and Apple owning podcasts. You know, Google Podcasts just shut down. And the way that we publish has... Those platforms have, you know, either stopped working, have been cannibalized. For instance, I just tried to log into our website and it's no longer working, you know, so like, and there's no social media anymore.
RIP.
I know. So it's just like, it's just become so.
I love the, yeah, I mean, yeah, whenever I hear the word enchitification, which was apparently invented by a journo, you know, 18 months ago or whatever, specifically about how the three companies that run communication globally are against us. They actually do not want quality.
No.
They want pure attention measured in numerical terms. And the way to get that is to just serve people addictive crap.
Yeah.
That makes them sad.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, going back to values again, building anything good or focusing on community.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's like it's been purposefully obfuscated to remove indie producers.
Yeah.
You know, like now it's sort of like, okay, well, now you've got to have a YouTube channel and now you've got to do reels and... You know, you need to be, I don't know, like it really became apparent to me. I was just in Sydney.
Sponsored.
I was just in Sydney with my sister and, you know, they've got small children. And YouTube for Kids is the most mind-blowing fucking thing you've ever seen. Like they're these videos where it's like a cooking video where someone is like just a camera making food, but then another person is telling a story, like a bedtime story over the top. And so the whole thing is designed so that like when you get bored of the story, you can watch the cooking. And then when you get bored of the cooking, you can watch the story. So it's like the whole thing is just...
At the same time.
At the same time. So the whole thing is just like turning our brains into mush. So it's just become incredibly onerous to publish. Like it takes us collectively three people about 15 hours to make a 30-minute episode once a month. That includes seeing the shows, recording, editing, doing all the social media, updating the website, doing the transcript. And we would just need, a lot of these podcasts have teams of like five people who work 20 hours a week or full time to publish one episode a week. And we don't have those resources.
No, and we don't want to have a distribution model that is mirroring that commercial intensification of everything.
Well,
you know,
true that too.
Podcasts are starting up and shutting down left, right and center. They're all trying the latest way to hack the algorithms. They're making 10-minute episodes or 1-hour episodes or both at the same time in the YouTube style. But look, it's been a ride. Let's pivot to celebrating the, you know, the two Australian Podcasting Awards, the 64 beautiful episodes, which as I scroll back through them, fill me with nostalgia, pride, pleasure. Maybe a question we can throw each other is one moment from across the aisle that will stay with you. How has it impacted you or connected with you in the most powerful way?
Well, the first thing I think of is winning the Australian Podcast Award in 2018 for arts and entertainment. Like, actually getting that validation was, I can still feel my hands were so numb when they were like reading out all of the names. So that was a huge, huge validation for all the hard work that we've done, and one that I actually sorely needed. But if we talk about shows, I still think like back when we sort of ended it the first time, we did like a top three, and I still think Passenger is one of the ones that just totally blew my mind. But the other one, Phil, apart from, you know, obviously, I'm thinking experiences, is when we went to hospital.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we went to hospital for...
And died.
What is it called? Yeah, and died.
The death one.
That has really stayed with me. Really stayed with me.
Yeah.
Yeah, how about you?
Arts House. Yeah, well, I want to propose as a little cluster all of the Sofitel Hotel experiences.
Yeah.
We saw Billa Durung by Joel Bray.
Oh, yes.
We saw Hotel Obscura, the one-on-one shows in hotel rooms. We interviewed Katie Svetkidis about the work that she'd done, you know, on that. And it's so interesting that Arts House actually were behind Hotel Obscura and that thing about experiencing death. You know, the venues like 45 Downstairs, Arts House, these marginalised little, often underground spaces. But then also Sofitel just stepping in, like this luxury hotel that's decided to say yes to some of the weirdest offers from the arts community. I just treasure these moments when this city is able to just, I don't know, be a proper festival, proper international place.
Yes.
So yes, thank you to Joel and all of the performers in Hotel Obscura, to Katie, to the Arts House. Those are the sorts of things that will really stay with me.
Who also did the dying show.
Exactly.
Which I can't look up the name because my website is broken. That's how I found out that my website was broken, because I couldn't find the name of the show just before recording. But yeah, that's it's the same production company, so they're obviously making really memorable work. And also, of course, getting to pick your brain every month, Phil, has been the most life-changing thing about this show.
Triage Live Art Collective.
Thank you very much.
Is the name for the record.
Thank you.
But yes, this doing the hilarious embargo where we turn to each other in silence if we're seeing the show together and then talk about something else camply. I love it.
Sometimes I just have to like hide my tears.
Sure. Yep. And like applaud ambiguously. But absolutely,
no, it's
the process
been awesome.
Itself, yeah, the opportunity to really debrief after some thinking time, after shows have been put in the drawer, going back to the memory and the notes that do or don't make sense after the event, and talking about impact. I think somehow your idea about how to shape each episode way back when has actually stood the test of time and led to this being quite a particular way of doing criticism, which I have treasured.
That's wonderful. Well, you and I will still be able to have our post-show discussions, and we'll have
exactly.
to
We're very
work
practiced
out how
now.
We do that
Straight
on the reg.
It.
Yeah. So if you see,
let's
see us
where the
out.
Goes.
Yeah, and if you see us out, come and have an impromptu Across the Aisle episode and talk to us about the show that we've just seen.
Yes.
All right, I think we've got our last show for the podcast and for Little Ones Theatre. Let's go to Sodom.
It's
Hooray.
All ending. Okay, over a decade ago, Little Ones Theatre arrived in Melbourne with an absolute cack, quote, production of Charles Boucher's Psycho Beach Party. It was a hit across the country with a slew of 5-star reviews and a Green Room Award win, and it had audiences cheering before the lights even came up. 10 years later, the company comes together for one last time to bring you another camp travesty from New York's Queen of Queer Theatre, just in time for Christmas. One of the longest running plays in off-Broadway history, Vampire Lesbians of Sodom by Charles Busch, tells the saga of two fatally seductive vampiresses whose paths first collide in ancient Sodom. Their bitter rivalry as bloodsuckers, but more importantly as actresses, endures for 2,000 years with stops along the way in 1920 silent movie Hollywood and contemporary Las Vegas. Vampire Lesbians of Sodom is a demented tribute to horror cinema and divas of the Golden Age. A cult camp classic comedy in the same vein as Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and Death Becomes Her. It's time to laugh and get your fangs out. All of that was pure recital from the hilariously camp material at the 45 Downstairs website. And I don't know, in a way that kind of speaks for itself. As I settled in for whatever the experience was going to be, the whole room was already thumping to the absurd Madonna-inflected soundtrack of Stephen Nicolazzo's Fandoms. You know, spotlights were circling, people were getting a cocktail and sitting down at a round table. It felt like it was already a lock. And that's before Jennifer Valetic and Artemis Ioannidis begin this amazing, like, bodily fluids-related flirtation that you know is just going to last centuries. But look, I don't need to describe plot because essentially this is all one-liners, immediate laugh lines, and camp affect. Ash Flanders has a kind of cameo appearance in the middle part of the production. And then in the Las Vegas sequence later in the show, all of these, you know, past favorites, friends of the company come out to do like an actual dance routine that has the audience squealing before Jennifer comes back in with a vacuum cleaner to literally mop up after whatever has just happened is over. And like, I will say that that image of Jennifer, who to me just embodies something about theatre in Melbourne over the last decades, dressed in some kind of onesie, which of course is going to later be a reveal, you know, pushing a Hoover back and forth at 45 Downstairs, was in itself like an image to be remembered. And what I've always loved about Little Ones Theatre and Stephen Nicolazzo's work, lit as always by Katie Svetkidis, is that it is for the memory of the visual moment. The fangs come out, the mouths open, the pose is struck, and we will hold that image in mind. It's theatre very much about the gesture, a staginess, a kind of stillness, really, where everything and nothing happens. It lends itself very well to photography and to memory. And so I will, you know, always hold some of these great Little Ones theatre moments in mind. I think the story of Little Ones is that Stephen is going to Adelaide for a, you know, great new job. And so things are just sort of reaching a natural conclusion. But it has been an amazing set of performances that are infusing our little archive as well. So it was the perfect way to wrap up. What was your night like, Carla?
Yeah, so I went to the very last show, which was beautiful and bittersweet, especially knowing that we were going to finish our show. Well, I knew at that time. And yeah, I thought it was like a really perfect sort of encapsulation for me, like where things are going as well. Like, we didn't cover Psycho Beach Party on our podcast because that was about, I'd say, like 6 months to a year before we began. But I think we covered every single Little One show after that. And I remember hearing all the buzz about Psycho Beach Party because it premiered at Bondi, something like Bondi kind of arts festival or whatever, and I was like, wow, this sounds great. Like, in parallel with Ash and Declan's Sisters Grimm, the last 10 years has been like such a ripe, even 15 for Sisters Grimm, such a ripe, wonderful, super queer camp theatre scene. So yeah, it was bittersweet. I really love that it was like It was very DIY. Like it was, I don't want to say it looked hastily put together, but it was exactly what you would expect from Charles Boosh. You know, there was not a stage to really speak of or a set. Thrifted costumes. Everybody looked very put together and gorgeous, though.
Mm.
And just that real queer DIY aesthetic. And I had to laugh. I was getting some glasses made just before the show. And she's like, oh, what are you doing? What play are you seeing? And I'm like, Lesbian Vampires of Sodom. When are we going to be able to say that anymore in Melbourne? When are we going to have moments like that? And
right.
I'll talk about the play in a sec, but I'm just on a roll on what this means that this is shutting down. Like, obviously, Declan Green is now at Griffin Theatre. So he and Ash aren't really making any Sisters Grimm work anymore. And with little ones on the way out, the whole play, although like I loved it, it was super entertaining, it was fun, I was just so sad the whole time because I was like, when do we honestly get to see like very gay looking women on stage, older women? When do we see sexualized fat people on stage in Melbourne? Literally never. Stephen is the only person who has put sexualized fat people on stage the whole time I've been living here in 15 years. You know, sexual and very fat people, you know, just women. So I feel like we're losing something incredibly special. And it's very telling also that not much has changed. The mark has not moved very much in the time that this company has been going. So grateful to Stephen and Eugene and Katie for all that they brought to Melbourne. But in terms of this show, look, you know, when you think Charles Boosh, Vampires, the Lesbians of Sodom, you got exactly what is on the box. Except with, you know, all of Stephen's fetishes in there. So there was a Madonna montage, dance along. There was allusions to the film Showgirls. There was extremely glamorous, gorgeous women of all ages and gorgeous, sexy, chubby, husky boys, you know, lots of Adidas. It was so fun. So raucous. I will say there was a moment at the end where the two vampires were going to go their own separate ways after 2,000 years of torturing each other. And they were like, oh, no, you know, I've realized that you're the one that I need all along. And I was about to go, boo! I did not want this sentiment in this show. What was that about?
No.
What was that about?
Well, I don't know. It was a rom-com twist for a horror film. Yeah, okay. Wrong genre.
You were the one all along. She was the most insufferable vampire I've ever met. So it was a fitting ending.
One of the things, yeah. Well, and the tone of those, you know, quotations, it's just so silent era Hollywood. Mm. My favorite phase of the play was that sort of like totally made up, you know, glamorous Hollywood backyard scene around the pool with all sorts of screenwriters and producers sort of popping out and gasping at each other, like, you know, cigars dropping to the floor, actresses fiercely fighting, trying to get each other's studio contract or whatever. It had no connection at all with history, biblical Hollywood, Las Vegas or otherwise.
Mm.
But the idea of just leaving all of that outside the door because, you know, we can be corrected later was part of the freedom that the work really generated. Yeah, so much fun.
Yeah, nothing else much to say except I hope to see these hotties continue to work, all of his ragtag troupe of regular performers. And please, where are all the gays? Where are all the super queers? Like, who's going to take up this mantle? Please do it.
Let's break the shackles of marriage equality and get back downstairs into the shadows forever. Ha, 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 ha,
thank you, little ones. Thank you for your service.
Okay, that is almost that, but it's time for a special edition of Coming Soon where we ask each other, now that you have all of your 15 hours back, what are you going to do? What will you do with all of this time free from across the aisle?
Oh my God. Well, hilariously, I've just realized that I'm probably going to spend quite a few months dismantling across the aisle and trying to unpick our digital footprint. But aside from that, I've actually got a really pared back year this year, which is great. And I'm going to tackle something that I've wanted to do for a very long time, which is watch all of Star Trek from beginning to where it is now, which I don't think is actually possible in a year. But that's what I'm going to do. And I'm also going to get my application together for fourth year psych, which I'm hoping to do next year. But the application will take quite a bit of work. And that's me. What about you?
Oh, I'm such a fan of completist projects. All of Star Trek. What a hashtag. I will be, speaking of hashtags, eating dal 50 times this year with 50 different people.
Yes, you've already started.
My New Year's resolution is more face, less phone. And the more face side of it is, yeah, dinners, specifically lentil dinners. So that's happening. I'm into the tarot. I'm making a sort of reinterpretation of the tarot for teachers called Tarot for Teachers.
And what do you mean by that? Like, is it a blog or what are you doing?
It'll be an online resource. At first, though, I need to just refine the 22 major arcana archetypes as aspects of the teaching profession.
Oh.
Which people can draw randomly or like focus on one aspect of their work and then get a pair of minor arcana cards as how are you going, where to next in that particular aspect of your professional life.
Oh my God, I love this.
There's so much really trite, yeah, it's working, yeah. There's so much trite discourse about teacher shortages and valuing the profession and whether we need to be paid more or have better conditions or whatever. But lost in all of that, including within the staff room, lost in all of that is, well, let's make some space to really think about extending students who are quote unquote gifted. Or let's think about dealing with particular types of parents and what it means for us in our practice. And I find that the shuffling of the tarot really assists in thinking through those things. So yeah, watch this space. Tarot for Teachers coming soon.
Oh, I love that. Have you done some, I mean, I think this is what I'm going to have to do this year as, you know, the internet is slowly getting taken offline. Have you done things like archived your bloggers and previous internet projects, URLs, emails, anything like that? No. I think that's what I'm going to have to try to start.
Who knows where any of this is?
I know.
Yeah. I think I do have a Word document of all of my daily projects from back in the day somewhere in my files. But yeah, it's all very precarious. And if the kids are watching cooking shows accompanied by storytelling, I mean, who knows what can be guaranteed at this point.
Yeah, I'm like, is it still there? How do I archive it? What do I do? I've got this like complicated setup with my email that I have no idea how I did it. And I think I'm actually going to have to like hire someone to unpick it all anyway. So this has like been the blessing and the curse of all of this, these free publishing, quote unquote, free publishing platforms is that it's like, who owns this now? Where did it go? What do I do with it? You know, anyway, I think that'll probably be part of my
and
year this year too.
How do we put it in the drawer?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well,
when am I going to have my dal with you, dal?
Well, exactly. And there's a question that I ask all of my dal dinos.
Oh.
So anyone listening who wants to have a dal with me, email. Everyone's welcome.
Wonderful.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We need to schedule that and do it.
We'll work it out.
More face.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks again, listener, for listening along. It means the world to us. And if you've made it this far and would like to send a heartfelt farewell message, get in touch via email at us@acrossisle.com or on the socials at Across Isle. Keep us on your following list so that you don't miss our evolution into our next and final form. Across the Isle is recorded in Naam and Jalung on the stolen lands of Wurundjeri and Wathaurong people. Sovereignty has never been ceded. We pay our respect to their elders and express gratitude for their custodianship of the land we live on. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land. And thank you so much, Carla. Au revoir.
Thank you, Philip. And thank you, Ron. Love you. And thank you for all of our listeners for all these years. It's like 9 years. Bye.
Bye.